Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Rosa Rodriguez versus Service Lloyd.
May it please the court, Mr. Caldwell Fletcher, counsel for petitioner, and Mr. Harry Decker on Amicus for Texas Workers' Compensation Commission will present arguments for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 4 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Fletcher will open with the first 8 minutes, and Mr. Decker will present rebuttal. My name is Caldwell Fletcher, and I represent Mrs. Rosa Rodriguez, who is here today, my client. I represented her at the commission level, at the appeals panel level, and again at the trial court level of this appeal of a new law workers' comp case. In reviewing the record, I'd like to initially correct two misstatements in the brief of Service Lloyd's. Service Lloyd's alleges on page Roman numeral little 13 of its brief that there was a second and subsequent set of administrative proceedings. That is not the case. Mrs. Rodriguez's impairment rating became final, and it was the original appeal of that was heard at the workers' compensation level. There was no, as in Manasco, original proceeding at the workers' comp commission that resulted in that becoming final. It was simply the operation of what we call the 90-day rule, or rule 130.5E. Secondly, the brief implies on page 2 that Mrs. Rodriguez had legal counsel at the time this first impairment rating became final. That's not the case. What occurred was that she retained counsel after the rating became final by operation of Rule 130.5E, and she stopped receiving benefits. Our appeal essentially goes to the dismissal of this case on the pleadings by the trial court based upon the allegation by Service Lloyd's that the substantial evidence rule should apply to our request for judicial review of this workers' comp case. Our response was that no, the preponderance of the evidence rule applied, and the trial court dismissed the case on the pleadings based upon special exceptions and our respectful refusal to eliminate certain claims in our pleadings, which we believe were supported by the evidence.
May I ask you a question?
Yes, sir.
Under either substantial evidence or preponderance, both would require a factual review, is that right?
I believe
so. Is it wholly a de novo review, or is it just modified? What can you do if under your theory of the case?
Under our theory of the case of what the pleading supported at the time of dismissal, we could litigate both the timeliness of Mrs. Rodriguez's dispute
The impairment rating,
yes, sir.
Even though the 90 days have gone by.
Our position was that we could relitigate that de novo to a jury, and that we could also litigate the validity of the impairment rating itself. As the court may recall, there was a substantial question below about whether the chiropractor that Mrs. Rodriguez saw initially, who gave her a 4% impairment rating, had before him all of the medical evidence. And we've cited in our reply brief jurisprudence that's been developed at the commission level, where the commission itself has recognized an exception to Rule 130.5E, and that is where there's compelling medical evidence of a previously undiagnosed.
Well, then how do you get past Monasco on the 90-day problem?
We believe Monasco is distinguishable, Your Honor, because we appealed the first rating. Monasco permitted a contested case hearing decision to become final. And this is the original appeal of Mrs. Rodriguez's case.
But you didn't appeal that initial rating until after 90 days.
That's correct.
And isn't there a provision that says that an appeal must be made within 90 days, otherwise it is final?
There's a commission rule that says that the impairment rating will be considered final if it is not challenged within 90 days.
And utilizing that framework, why wouldn't we then apply the same analysis that we did in Monasco to rule that it is final and can't be raised again?
Because as a practical matter, the quality of this challenge to the impairment rating entails both a challenge to the validity of the impairment rating itself, and the Commission recognizes that if an impairment rating is invalid, Rule 30.5E itself will not be triggered. And we've attached to the appendix in our reply brief a case that we believe fairly summarizes the Commission's jurisprudence in this regard, and it basically says that there's a common thread running through these cases where Rule 135E will be found not to have been triggered, and that is that there's an element of the compensable injury that was not included in the first impairment rating, and it was either diagnosed or arose after the expiration of a 90-day period. That was our claim below. And that is our claim at the trial court. There is no appellate decision engrafting this commission line of cases on the jurisprudence of Texas workers' compensation law. And we believe that the trial courts need to be guided by what the commission has learned in interpreting Rule 130.5E. Particularly in light of some of the public policy questions that may be presented to claimants when they receive their first impairment rating. I think that a lot of times claimants will see company doctors or so-called independent medical examiners, which will then result in the first impairment rating. And these ratings, in fact, may be invalid. And if subsequent compelling medical evidence shows that circumstances indicate that the rating was invalid, claimants ought to be able to challenge commission findings in trial court that the impairment rating has become final or that it is a valid impairment rating.
What's to keep an employee from sandbagging, not putting on the case before the agency?
Judge, I'm not aware of anything in the Act that requires that. I do know that the way the Commission requires us to conduct our business there, that is, it's possible. But perhaps there could be a finding by the Commission that that's the prima facie case was not put on.
Prima facie case on.
At the administrative level. Of either a challenge to the impairment rating, or I would think the commission would be the best party to deal with sandbagging at the commission level. My esteemed counsel for Amicus is going to address the balance of the argument unless there's further questions.
Good morning. My name is Harry Deckard. I work for the Attorney General's Office, and I represent the Texas Workers' Compensation Commission. And we filed an amicus brief in this case.
Let me ask you the question.
Yes, sir.
What's to keep an employee from sandbagging?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean,
That's what exhaustion remedies is.
Exactly. And I agree. There should be an exhaustive remedies. I suppose the best way to answer that is to digress a little bit and explain that we think Vinasco is right, that you have to present your case before the commission. Well, the reason we file our amicus brief in this case is not so much a concern about that, it's the way the trial court dealt with this. What they did was they dismissed this lawsuit on the grounds that they didn't plead under the proper standard of review. We believe that the standard of review in this case is preponderance of evidence because this is a case that involves income benefits. It directly relates to Ms. Rodriguez's retirement. Now, in answer to the earlier question,
but doesn't that viewpoint entail the necessity of having a record from some other source?
No, Your Honor.
It entails the opportunity to have a completely full trial before the trial court.
Well, no, Your Honor. I don't believe it does. I think.
Well, what kind of record would you make under your viewpoint of the?
If I was trying the case,
yeah.
I would order the commission record filed with the trial court. My position would be that, based on a preponderance of the evidence, if there is evidence to support my claim that the impairment rating did not become final by operation of Rule 130.5E,
because the initial impairment
rating was invalid because based on a misdiagnosis. And the reason I suggest that argument is because in this particular case, now recognize this is not like the typical impairment rating case where you've got competing impairment ratings. This is simply one where one has not become final. There may be fact questions relating to whether or not there actually was a dispute which occurred within 90 days. I understand there was a stipulation made in this case, but that stipulation may have been invalid. But more importantly, the commission has carved out an exception which the appeals panel addressed, which has to do with whether or not an initial impairment rating was valid or not. In other words, the commission has recognized in some cases that an impairment rating is invalid if it was either based on a misdiagnosis or if the impairment rating was arrived at was due to a significant error.
And as a misdiagnosis, the doctor that gave the impairment rating said one thing, a second doctor said a different thing. Is that a misdiagnosis?
I'm sorry, could you ask?
I want to reflect on this misdiagnosis issue.
Certainly.
Well, is it a misdiagnosis when the doctor who gave the impairment rating says, whoops, I made a mistake, or is it a misdiagnosis where you've got a dispute in the record as to whether or not there was a mistake?
Well, actually, it could occur in both cases. The first case is a common example where the original doctor that certified the impairment rating changes his mind. The most obvious example that occurs from time to time is where the patient actually gets worse. I guess what confuses this is the substantial change of condition issue.
So your argument that your position for the Workers' Compensation Commission is that the district court ought to be able to consider whether or not the impairment rating is valid?
If the appeals panel addressed it, which they did in this case.
As an appellate level, you're not arguing here that for the first time in district court,
we very much support the Minasco opinion in the sense that the whole premise that the new law turns on is that you've got to adjudicate an issue prior to raising it in the modified trial de novo procedures in district court. We absolutely agree with that. But in this case, and the reason we think our concern in this case is the way the trial court disposed of it. They asked Ms. Rodriguez to replead based on substantial evidence review, and that's just not right. I mean, and the way I understand substantial evidence review, first of all, it's got to happen in Travis County, at least under the workers' comp. Second of all, you've got to provide a commission record. The court's review of the record is then, or at least review of that issue is based solely on the record, and trial court makes a decision or not.
Well, this really isn't either one, is it? It's not an evidentiary review. This is a question of law.
No, because I believe there are factual questions.
What question is there other than did she contest the impairment rating within the 90 days or not?
Yes, and whether or not there's medical evidence to support the notion that the original impairment rating is invalid or not. I'm not saying Mr. Rodriguez is right or wrong. I'm just saying the standard review that the trial court imposed upon Ms. Rodriguez when it dismissed her case is wrong.
Can you distinguish what you're advocating here from the Manasco situation?
Absolutely.
Why wouldn't this exception swallow the rule?
Yes, Your Honor. Because in Manasco, they only got so far as a contested case hearing. Then they wanted to appeal the impairment rating into district court and urge substantial change of condition. Well, as I read the Manasco opinion, you can't appeal a contested case hearing officer's decision into district court and urge substantial change of condition. The reason this case is different is because Ms. Rodriguez has gone through the whole process. There was a BRC, a CCH, and an appeals panel. But in this case, the appeals panel determined that the impairment rating became final by operation of Rule 130.5E. And the two obvious exceptions to an impairment rating becoming final under Rule 130.5E is, first of all, there was a dispute within 90 days. Or second of all, there's this exception that the commission has carved out. I recognize this is not the statute, but the commission has recognized that if the impairment rating is invalid, then you can challenge the validity of the impairment rating.
Did you do that in the hearing that was afforded you?
I'm sorry.
Did Mrs. Rodriguez do that in the hearing that was afforded you in the administrative process?
Yes, Your Honor.
The exception and put on evidence.
You mean before the commission or at the
court?
I believe they did.
There was an adverse decision.
Yes, it was an adverse decision. The contested case hearing officer, I believe, found that it was valid. There was no compelling medical evidence, and that was appealed to the appeals panel. The appeals panel affirmed that finding, and that Ms. Rodriguez was then in turn appealing those determinations.
Well, I'm still at a loss to understand how, when you're now in the district court contesting, that you're arguing that a preponderance of the evidence standard applies to the review of all those hearings.
That's the way it's set up under the statute. I mean, there's two standards of review under the statute. There's preponderance of the evidence for all issues relating to compensability, income, or death benefits. Since this involves an impairment rating issue, which directly affects Ms. Rodriguez's entitlement to impairment income benefits or supplemental income benefits, then we believe that it falls under preponderance of evidence standard of review described under Section 410.301. If it was anything else, for example, attorney fees or some of the other issues that are described in the Pride opinion.
And so, if I understand, then the trial court reviews the record to determine whether your viewpoint is under preponderance of the evidence the initial impairment rating was invalid.
Yes.
As opposed to the substantial evidence rule, which is a broader.
Yes, and the standard we believe would be preponderance of evidence, and perhaps if you have a fact issue, it should go to the jury. Perhaps this case should have.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Yes.
May it please the court, Evelyn T. Isles will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, I'm Evelyn Isles and I represent Service Lloyd. Service Lloyd's position is basically twofold. First, that this court has no jurisdiction to resolve Mrs. Rodriguez's complaint because she failed to exhaust administrative remedies on any of her claims except the constitutional issue, which I believe is waived because she has not briefed that at the Court of Appeals to the Texas Supreme Court. In other words, no jurisdiction except for constitutional issues because those can't be raised at the administrative level and those are waived, even though I'm not a big waiver fan. Our second position is that what the petitioner is trying to do is create an exception to this 90-day rule created by Rule 130.5E. We believe that this is a question of law, whether the trial court should carve out an exception to the absolute 90-day rule. As a simple question of law, it should be resolved under the substantial evidence rule, in Travis County where the court simply looks at the record. There's no fact issue here. I'm just asking whether the court should recognize an exception.
Is it your view that once the IR rating becomes final by failure to challenge it within 90 days, that that can no longer be appealed inside the agency?
Yes, Your Honor.
So that's it. You can't go to a contested hearing or appeals officer or anybody else.
Right. And I think that the rule is fair. It provides the claimant and the carrier 90 days if they have any complaint, initial impairment rating. If there is a complaint, the claimant can go to the commission and say 4% is too low, and the commission is required to appoint a designated doctor who will go in. The finality of the initial impairment rating is waived. It's no longer final. You get a new doctor to reassess the situation. So, I mean, there's a fair procedure in place. Yes, yes, Your Honor.
After 90 days, then there is no relief for a changed condition, whether it was a correct diagnosis or not. If a more serious injury develops.
Yes, Your Honor. That is my position, but you have to realize that within that 90 days, Mrs. Rodriguez could have come in and complained. And if she didn't get what she, you know, if they didn't, the designated doctor didn't change her impairment rating, she could take that right through each step. The BRC.
No, I'm on this maximum medical improvement rating.
Okay.
Once that's made and 90 days have gone by, neither side can contend with it.
That is my position, yes, Your Honor.
If it was, if the worker has improved after 90 days, the insurance company cannot come in and contest it.
No, Your Honor.
And if the initial injury develops into a much more serious injury,
right. No
one can contest it.
Right. Exactly. And I believe that there's a reason for this 90-day rule, and it's really important. Because it makes the claimant look, see what's going on. If there is a problem, they need to act. I mean, there has to come some point where there's some finality.
Of course, at that point, there is rarely a lawyer involved.
There
was not in this case.
Right. And if I misstated the record, I certainly apologize. I can check on that, but an attorney can be involved. And while we're talking about the Rule 130, this rule, this absolute 90-day rule, and whether we're going to carve out exceptions, I think it's just important for the court to know that there are cases pending out there, and one of them happens to be mine, when we're questioning whether the commission can unilaterally carve out exceptions to this, you know, Rule 130. Here we're talking about an exception based on misdiagnosis. Well, there's cases out there that say the commission has no power to unilaterally carve out exceptions to the absolute 90-day rule.
And you don't believe the court has the power to do anything?
This court has the power probably to do anything.
I thought you said we didn't have any.
You know, I really don't believe in jurisdiction because she didn't, it's Manasco. That I can't find any significant distinction in Manasco. Same fact. You get your initial IR rating. Both claimants missed the 90-day window. They both missed it. Then they both come back to the commission, and then they start going through the channels. What the petitioner fails to realize here is that if she would have went through the channels within the 90 days, BRC, CHA, appeals panel, district court, then they'd be sitting pretty, and they could come in and challenge that.
Well, in Manasco, they waited too long to appeal to the district court, didn't they?
Right.
Time's filed. Once you miss that deadline. But the confusing thing I have here is, if you're right, when do substantial changes in conditions ever become relevant?
I believe it comes relevant if you timely failed that initial impairment rating within the 90 days.
Can you say in a year I'm going to get worse? Can you
you make a future term challenge?
Well,
to preserve your potential rights?
I guess you might have to do that.
So everybody will do that.
But I don't understand why should it be different that you're adjudicated an IR and you lose, and now you want to argue substantial change of conditions, or it's not adjudicated, it just becomes final by the passage of time, and you want to argue substantial. What's the difference?
Well, you mean into district court? Why you would
or
argue
in the
that?
Commission?
Well, I'm going to keep saying within the 90 days because that's all that I think the client has. Well, if you got a 4% impairment rating and you complained about it and you went to the commission and showed evidence of that the doctor misdiagnosed you and they ruled against you and you took it up through the administrative level into district court, then you could raise before the trial court that issue again. Yes, sir.
On this issue, this new comp scheme came into existence after, I presume, the legislature was well aware of the problem with asbestos and silicosis and some industrial diseases that we know are out there that have various stages, whether you may go to the next stage or you may not. But in each stage, there are discrete injuries that you suffer. Now, why assume into that environment that a workers' comp statute would be written in such a way that the impairment rating you get on that date is the only impairment rating you'll ever have if what you're dealing with is an industrial disease? If I start out with simply asbestosis, then you're saying that I get an impairment rating based on asbestosis of one level. If I disagree because I fear I'll develop lung cancer, I should litigate it all within that 90 days. That'd be your position. Otherwise, it cannot ever be opened up again. How can we assume the legislature intended that to be the way that this statute operated?
Well, you have a good point. It would be my response, again, that the legislature has provided that 90-day window, which is party neutral, and maybe that they don't want the commission to get into these type of bringing in doctors, claiming malpractice, misdiagnosis. I mean, you do have doctors there diagnosing the claimant, and it's usually their treating physician who gives them the initial IR rating.
Why couldn't the commission have the latitude of determining that, say, if all you're going to argue is I disagree with the diagnosis, that's going to be final in 90 days, and make an exception? Well, if it turns out that you really do develop cancer, then that's a substantially changed condition independent of a misdiagnosis, and we will allow you to bring that up after the original impairment rating session. What's wrong with reading the statute that way?
Okay, Your Honor, I will just say that the statute says that the claimant shall bring any complaint to the IR rating within 90 days. I mean, that's what the statute, I mean, I'm sorry, it's a rule. That's what the rule says, which is clear as can be. And they have a 90-day window, it's party neutral. If this court wants to carve out exceptions, I understand that, and I understand your concern. But again, you're going to have to also ask whether the commission and ultimately this court can carve out exceptions to that 90-day rule. I understand that you're saying this is unfair, but to me, you have a treating doctor.
I don't know if it's unfair. You're just saying here's a rule that says there's 90 days. Since the rule has no exceptions, and the commission that's in charge of enforcing the rule has no authority to create exceptions. That's your argument.
Right.
And so my argument, fair or not, my argument is, how do I get to the conclusion that the commission has no authority to create exceptions?
I was thinking of, I didn't realize, and forgive me, that this case was going to turn into such a 90-day rule case, but I may file some post-submission briefing on that. But there's no authority under the statutes for the commission to just unilaterally change the rules. I mean, they have to go to Austin, there's a rulemaking procedure, but they have been doing it. This misdiagnosis what we're talking here exception. I think that's basically what Ms. Rodriguez is claiming, that she's misdiagnosed. The commission's been doing it for years, saying there's an exception to the 90-day rule. And I'm just out of courtesy trying to tell y'all that there are cases out there that say they can't do it, that the rule is absolute, it's party neutral, it gives the claimant the right to come in and get another a designated doctor, an independent doctor. And I guess maybe I'm just a cold, hard insurance defense attorney, but it sounds fair to me.
But what role does the substantial change of condition exception play? That's not a commission-made rule. That's a
statute. Okay, I know that I'm not being clear. Forgive me. But I'm saying that if a claimant appeals that initial IR rating within 90 days, takes it up through the administrative process, if they're still dissatisfied, so the appeals panel affirms the 4%, then at the district court level, they have the opportunity through this evidentiary rule of Monasco, Justice Abbott wrote that, to bring in other evidence.
It's only if conditions have changed, not if they haven't changed.
Right, and if they have.
I mean, the claimant may say, well, that was right at the time, but since then, something else has done, and the statute gives them a right to bring that up.
If they've exhausted administrative remedies, I guess that's what I'm going to call.
Yeah, but if the substantial change comes on the 91st day, or 4 or 5 months later, substantial change to me is, just as Heck has pointed out, the original diagnosis may be correct, but a substantial change is a more serious or a different result of the original injury. And what do you do with that condition?
You know, Your Honor, I don't know, and I'll think about that a little bit. I'll tell you honestly, I don't know if you have a new injury that the claimant could go back to the commission and seek more compensation for, you know, asbestosis versus lung cancer. I don't know. These fine workers' comp attorneys could probably tell you. But I understand your concern there. But I know there has to be some order to this. There has to be something else. And I think I've touched on everything.
Any other questions?
I thank you for your time. That is perfect.
I've got 4 minutes. I'll try to answer that question if I can. A typical example would be a back injury. You have an impairment rating based on a limited range of motion. Later on, it's determined you need a fusion. That further diminishes your range of motion to the point where your impairment rating is dramatically increased, or should be. At that point, my belief is that the remedy would be that you go back to the commission. You would argue that the original impairment rating was invalid because it was based on a diagnosis or a misdiagnosis because of the fact that the doctor had at that point in time. There is now compelling medical evidence to show that, in fact, my condition is worse than they originally suspected, because look what I had to go through. My impairment rating should be, my original impairment rating is invalid and should be set aside.
Well,
I think
is that different from substantial change of condition?
Yes, it is.
And is it necessary in this case to decide whether the commission has the power to make that additional exception in order to adjudicate this case, which I thought was being argued on substantial change of condition?
Yes, no, it isn't. And that's where we all get derailed. This is different. Monasco is right. Begin with the premise that Monasco is right. We agree with that. Where everybody gets derailed is on the substantial change of condition issue. Monasco is right. That is an evidentiary matter. In other words, once you have an ordinarily disputed impairment rating where you have a designated doctor, a treating doctor, and an insurance company doctor all coming up with different impairment ratings, and that's before the trial court, then the injured worker can file a motion for a substantial change of condition to ask the designated doctor to reconsider his impairment rating. And then that new evidence can come in before the jury.
This whether this impairment rating was wrong or made or not, doesn't impact the principal argument, which I understand is in this case, which is whether there has been a substantial change of condition. And do
well,
they get to show that de novo?
Yes, Your Honor. That is confusing because in many cases you're kind of reaching the same result, but you're characterizing it differently. At least that's the way I view it. I've read some recent appeals panel decisions that, talk about the substantial change of condition in connection with an original invalid impairment rating. And the position they take is, well, you're not necessarily entitled to a new impairment rating because you have a substantial change of condition, unless you can tie the substantial change of condition to an improper diagnosis. That's usually how they view it.
The statute is confusing because it allows submission of evidence that would probably produce a different result if admitted into evidence at the trial, which is anything.
Well, yes, but I think the best way to handle this with the limited time I have is the problem here is the way the trial court dealt with the standard of review. In other words, what we believe should have happened is you have the issue that before the trial court was whether the impairment rating became final under Rule 130.5E. What Ms. Rodriguez should have been able to do is adjudicate those issues before the trial court, either in a bench trial, summary judgment proceeding, or before a jury, under the preponderance of evidence standard of review. The result will be you'll either have the finder of fact will either find that it is final, and in that case, the only recourse that Ms. Rodriguez has is to go back to the commission and argue a substantial change, or basically invalid, the same argument again, really, but maybe new evidence based on some other theory that she might have. Or if the trier of fact finds that it was not final, that is, the impairment rating was not final by operation of Rule 130.5E, then you have a reversed appeals panel decision on the issue of finality. Then it goes back to the commission. Now, the trial court doesn't remand it. We believe the Court of Appeals is right in that regard. The trial court doesn't remand it, but you have a reversed appeals panel decision on the finding of finality. So at that point, the designated doctor process is invoked. The commission will appoint a designated doctor. And then you will have an impairment rating based on the designated doctor's report or contesting doctor's reports. And then at that stage, once you have an impairment rating based on that process, then, and if Ms. Rodriguez is still unhappy with it, or if the insurance company is still unhappy with it, then they can appeal that to district court. You have a standard impairment rating dispute where you've got a designated doctor impairment rating, you've got a treating doctor impairment rating, and you've got an insurance company doctor impairment rating. At that stage, I suppose Ms. Rodriguez, if she's able to establish it, could assert substantial change of condition. Otherwise, it's just treated like an ordinary impairment rating. And that's what makes this case confusing, because it's one of these 134.
You've gone beyond the
question.
Yes. Thank you, Eric.
Thank you. That concludes the second argument. We'll take another brief.
All right.